And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Well, right now it is storming. When I came in, it was sleeting and snowing and raining. So it's going to be an interesting evening. Well, the clown show continues. Democrats are incensed that Trump has fired quite a number of people working in the White House. But that's what you do when you've got disloyal people. You get rid of them. And that's what he has been doing. All right. This particular show, I got a book today. I'd actually ordered it, but I got a review copy from the publisher. It's about Dark Fleet, the secret Nazi space program. Now, very few people seem to be aware that the Nazis put a man into orbit during World War II. And they were quite advanced. The man that ran their program was none other than Wernher von Braun, who became the head of the American space program. Now, in the process of researching all this, I came across something called the Project Serpo, which was supposedly a top-secret human exchange program. Now, according to the information in what was given to me, it was written by a retired employee of the U.S. government, but he was involved in a special program. He said, Roswell happened, but not like what the books say. There were two crash sites, one southwest of Corona, New Mexico, and a second site at Pelona Peak, south of the Till in New Mexico. The crash involved two extraterrestrial aircraft. The Corona site was found a day later by an archaeology team, and I've talked about that. It was a team made up of students. The team reported the crash site to the Lincoln County Sheriff's Department. A deputy arrived the next day, summoned the state police officer. One alien, living, was found hiding behind a rock. He was given water but declined food, and he was transferred to Los Alamos. Now, this was reported to Roswell Army Airfield. The site was examined, all evidence was removed. And the bodies of the dead aliens were taken to Los Alamos Laboratory because they had a freezing system that allowed the bodies to remain frozen to be used for research. The craft was taken to Roswell and then on to Wright Field in Ohio. Now, the second site, according to this story, wasn't discovered until August of 1949 by two ranchers. They reported their findings several days later to the Sheriff of Catron County in New Mexico. And because of the remote location, it took the sheriff several days to make his way up to the crash site. Once at the site, the sheriff took photos and drove back to Detil. Sandia Army Base in Albuquerque was then notified. A recovery team from Sandia took custody of all the evidence, including six additional bodies. Bodies were taken to Sandia Base, but later transferred to Los Alamos. The live entity that had been found at the first site established communications with us and gave us the location of his home planet. He lived until 1952 when he died. But before his death, he gave us a full explanation of the items found inside the two craft. And one item was a communications device. And under supervision, he was allowed to make contact with his home planet. A meeting was set up for April 1964 in the Alamogordo, New Mexico. Aliens landed, retrieved the bodies of their dead comrades. Information was exchanged. Communication was in English. Seems the aliens had a translation device. Well, in 1965, we began an exchange program with the aliens. We sent 12 military personnel, 10 men and 2 women. They were trained, vetted, and carefully removed from the military system. And they were skilled in various specialties. Near the northern part of the Nevada test site, the aliens landed and the 12 Americans got on board the craft and left. One alien was left on Earth in exchange. The original plan is for our 12 people to stay 10 years and then return to Earth. But, like all plans of mice and men, something went wrong. The 12 remained until 1978, when they were returned to the same location in Nevada. There were 7 men and 1 woman that was returned. 2 died on the aliens' home planet. 4 others decided to stay, according to the returnees. Of the 8 that came back, all have now died. The last survivor died in 2002. The returnees were isolated from 78 until 84 at various military installations. The Air Force Office of Special Investigation was responsible for their security and safety and conducted debriefing sessions with the returnees. Now, there's never been anything written about the exchange program. Linda Howe did make reference to it, but she didn't have much information. Excuse me. Now, there were several comments to this. One was made by Gene Laskowski, who is the person that wrote it. Most of the information is correct. However, I never heard of any females going. To my knowledge, we sent 12 men, all military men, 8 Air Force, 2 Army, and 2 Navy. He said, I think the females are a red herring, but maybe he didn't have the clearance to know about that. He said they left and were gone 20 years. When they came back, they were put in quarantine for a year at the complex. Only 8 did come back of the 12. 2 died a few years into their assignment on the Vistra's planet. 2 others decided to remain and couldn't actually be alive today. Since their return, all have died, the last being in 2003 in a VA hospital. As for the Roswell incident, according to what I'm reading, the email that I started out reading was correct. The complete debriefing is contained in Project Serpo, final report. Now, one of the females, one was supposedly a doctor and the other was a linguist. The EBE planet is located within a solar system, it is a reticuli star system. The planet had 2 suns, but their angles were small and allowed some darkness on the planet depending on one's location. Now, the planet was tilted that allowed the northern part to be cooler. It's a little less in size than Earth. The atmosphere was similar to Earth's and contained the elements of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. It's 37 light years from us. It took 9 months for the our team to travel to that planet. During the trip, each of the team members were dizzy, disoriented, and suffered headaches. Once the team arrived on the planet, it took several months to adjust to the atmosphere. During the adjustment period, they suffered headaches, dizziness, and disorientation. The bright suns of the EBE planet also presented problems. Although they had sunglasses, they still suffered from the bright sunlight and the dangerous sun exposure. The radiation level of the planet was higher than that of Earth, so they had to be covered at all times. There was no refrigeration except in the alien industry. The temperatures of the planet at the center portion stayed between 94 and 115. They did have clouds and rain, but not frequently. The northern hemisphere of the planet, the temperature dropped to between 55 and 80. That was too cool for the EBEs, or at least most of them. The team eventually relocated to the north in order to stay cool. The ground transportation was similar to a helicopter. Power system was a sealed energy device that provided electrical power and lift for the craft. Easy to fly, and our pilots learned the system within days. They did have vehicles that floated above the ground and didn't have tires or wheels. There were leaders, but no real form of government. Virtually no crime They had an army, which also acted as the police force. But no guns or weapons of any time were seen by the team. Regular meetings within each small community. There was one large community that acted as a central point of the civilization. All the industry was at this one large community. There was no money, as we understand money. Every alien was issued what they needed. There were no stores, malls, or shopping locations. There were central distribution centers where they went to obtain items of need. And all of them worked in some capacity. Children were kept isolated. The only trouble our team members got into was when they attempted to photograph the children. The Army escorted them away and cautioned them not to do it again. Now, the diameter of the alien planet was reported as 7,218 miles. Distance from its sun number one was 96.5 million miles. From sun two, 91.4 million miles. There were two moons. Rotation was 43 hours. Orbit was 865 days. We just had a weather advisory issued until tomorrow. Let's see what it says. FEMA is making this report. It covers here. Winter storm brings widespread snowfall across the mountains and the lowlands. Snow accumulations up to 2 inches. Wind gusts as high as 35 miles an hour. Where portions of south central, southwest New Mexico, and southwest Texas until 5 a.m. tomorrow. Covers El Paso and Las Cruces. It's interesting. Well, the planet was Serpo. The nearest planet to Serpo is called Otto. Okay. Well, there's a number of interesting things that have come to light recently. One of which is Project Horizon, which was a project of the U.S. Army to build a permanent moon base. Let's see. Well, that's nothing but the Nazi space program. It is known that they had several crashed UFOs to reverse engineer. One was found in the North Sea by Nazi researchers. Another was given to them by the Italians. And in fact, it's based on their reverse engineering that they developed, according to the story, the V-2. And the V-2, which became the Saturn rocket. Eventually, the concept was the same. Now, according to the book I received today called Dark Fleet by Lynn Kasten, the Nazis didn't really lose World War II. I mean, they were willing to sacrifice their military. They made it appear they lost in order to divert attention from the alliance they made with a race of aliens known as the Reptilians, an ancient galactic civilization obsessed with conquest and domination. Now, it is known that in the ruins of Berlin, quite a number of odd-looking corpses were found wearing black robes similar to those you find in a monastery. After the German surrender in 1945, the Nazi Reptilian Alliance infiltrated the U.S. military-industrial complex through Operation Paperclip. Now, Paperclip, the concept was good. They wanted to obtain as many Nazi scientists as they could. and anybody who was what was considered a Russian expert. Now, unfortunately, they also got a lot of less than competent people who made it appear that they were Russian experts. A couple of them became doctors for the military and did more damage than you could ever imagine. Now, Paperclip was a secret program of the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, carried out by special agents of Army CIC, in which more than 1,600 German scientists, engineers, and technicians, such as Wernher von Braun and his V-2 rocket team, were taken from Germany to America for U.S. government employment between 1945 and 1959. Many were former members and some were former leaders of the Nazi Party. Primary purpose of Paperclip was U.S. military advantage in the Soviet-American Cold War and the space race. Now, the Soviet Union was more aggressive in forcibly recruiting more than 2,200 German specialists, total of more than 6,000 people, including family members, with Operation Osoviakim during one night in October 22, 1946. The Joint Chiefs of Staff actually established the first secret recruitment program. It was called Operation Overcast. It was established June 20th, 1945, initially to assist in shortening the Japanese war and aid our post-war military research. The term Overcast was the name first given by the German scientist family members for the housing camp where they were held in Bavaria. Late summer of 1945, the Joint Chiefs of Staff established the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, or JIOA, a subcommittee of the Joint Intelligence Community to directly oversee Operation Overcast and later Operation Paperclip. The JIOA representatives included the Army's Director of Intelligence, the Chief of Naval Intelligence, Assistant Chief of Air Staff, Air Force Intelligence, and a representative from the State Department. In November of 1945, the Operation Overcast was renamed Operation Paperclip by the Ordnance Corps officers, who would attach a paperclip to the folders of those rocket experts they wanted to employ in America. Now, in a secret directive circulated on September 3rd, 1946, President Truman officially approved Paperclip and expanded it to include 1,000 German scientists under temporary, limited military custody. Now, the beginnings of this actually came in the latter part of World War II. Nazi Germany found itself at a logistical disadvantage when it failed to conquer Russia with Operation Barbarossa. The siege of Leningrad was lost, and Operation Nordlicht, or Northern Light, and the Battle of Stalingrad was lost. The failed conquest had depleted German resources as military-industrial complex wasn't prepared to defend the Greater German Reich against the Red Army's westward counterattack. So by early 1943, the German government began recalling from combat a number of scientists, engineers, and technicians. They put them back to work in research and development to bolster German defenses for a protracted war with Russia. Among those recalled were 4,000 rocketeers sent to Peenemünde in northern coastal Germany. Overnight, PhDs were liberated from KP duty, masters of science recalled from orderly service, mathematicians were taken out of bakeries, and precision engineers were removed from being truck drivers. Excuse me. You know, up until that point in time, the Nazi government viewed intellectuals with some distrust. But they recalled them for scientific work. First, they had to identify and locate the scientists, engineers, and technicians, and then determine their political reliability. Werner Osenberg, the engineer scientist heading the Defense Research Association, recorded the names of the politically cleared men to the Osenberg list. This resulted in their reinstatement to scientific work. In March of 45, at Bonn University, a Polish laboratory technician found pieces of the Osenberg list stuffed in a toilet. And the list was subsequently sent to MI6, who gave it to U.S. intelligence. And then U.S. Army Major Robert Staver, chief of the Jet Propulsion Section of the Research and Intelligence Branch of the U.S. Army Ordnance Corps, used the Osenberg list to compile his list of German scientists that had to be captured and interrogated. Number one on the list was Wernher von Braun, Germany's premier rocket scientist. Now, in Operation Overcast, Staver's original intent was only to interview the scientist. What he later learned changed the operation's purpose. May 22nd, 1945, he transmitted to the U.S. Pentagon headquarters Colonel Joel Holmes' telegram urging the evacuation of German scientists and their families as most important for the Pacific War effort. Most of the Osenberg List engineers worked at the Baltic Coast German Army Research Center at Peenemünde developing the V-2 rocket. After capturing them, the Allies initially housed them and their families in Landshut in Bavaria in southern Germany. Beginning July 19, 1945, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff managed the captured rocketeers into Operation Overcast. But when the Camp Overcast name of the scientist quarters became locally known, the program was renamed Operation Paperclip. And that was to try to keep it secret. You know, part of the problem was most of these folks were actually pro-Nazi. In fact, Wernher von Braun was supposedly a firm Nazi till the day he died. And Truman had said no Nazi, no member of the Nazi Party, no member of the SS, or the member of the Romanian Nine Guard could come to this country for any reason. So what did intelligence do? They just changed their files to remove the references. Now, the most of these... before he officially approved the program, Truman was indecisive. Years later, in 63, he recalled he wasn't in the least reluctant to approve Paperclip. And because of relations with Russia, this had to be done, and it was done. And several of the Paperclip scientists were later investigated because of their links to the Nazi Party during the war. And only one Paperclip scientist, George Rickhey, was formally tried for any crime, and no Paperclip scientist was found guilty of a crime in America or Germany. Rickhey was returned to Germany in 47 to stand trial at the Dora trial, but he was acquitted. In 1951, weeks after his U.S. arrival, Walter Schreiber was linked by the Boston Globe to human experiments conducted by Kurt Blom at Ravensbrück. Rather than try him, he immigrated to Argentina with the aid of the U.S. military. In 1984, Arthur Rudolph, under perceived threat of prosecution related to his connection as operation director for V-2 missile production, to the use of forced labor at Metal Baldora at the metal work, renounced his U.S. citizenship and moved to West Germany, which granted him citizenship. In other words, after the war, everybody wanted to forget about the Nazis. For 50 years, from 63 to 2013, the Strughold Award, named after Herbertus Strughold, the father of space medicine, for his central role in developing innovations like the spacesuit and space life support system, is the most prestigious award from the Space Medicine Association. October 1st, 2013, in the aftermath of a Wall Street Journal article published December 1st, 2012, that highlighted his connection to human experiments during World War II, The Space Medicine Association Stronghold Award was retired, but it's still considered extremely prestigious to have it. You have to wonder, did anybody want to punish anyone who committed war crimes? The the sad thing about the many of those in Operation Paperclip is they were considered to literally be above the law. Now, the it's no secret that our space program is based almost entirely on Nazi research. And Wernher von Braun was the man who headed it up. Now, there were several other individuals involved, most of whom vanished at the end of the war. The sad thing is everybody, to anyone who could help us in our Cold War, a blind eye was turned to any of their crimes. I've talked to a number of people. A lot of the scientists were brought to Fort Bliss and White Sands Proving Ground, which is not too far from here. They were considered War Department special employees. And there was a well-known Nazi spy program that took a lot of that information south. Everyone knew it, but nobody wanted to be the one to upset the apple cart. You know, there was an ethical cost to bringing all these people into the country. It's much like the issues today with the illegal immigrants or the undocumented immigrants or whatever you want to call them. The law is very clear. If you're not documented to come here, to be here is a crime. And there are those who want to turn a blind eye because, well, it's morally right to bring anybody who wants to come. That's why you have people defecating in the streets in Los Angeles. You have more homeless in that one city than in some states. And money that is supposed to go for citizens and their welfare vanish into some kind of special secret program to bring more undocumented immigrants here. And at some point in time, you have to decide, does the rule of law govern this country, or do the wishes of perhaps well-meaning individuals, is that more important? There is a there are a number of stories about Let's see. There are a number of stories about the fact that the Nazis set up bases that we never found. I had several people tell me about the fact that in Antarctica, SAS fought the Nazis in an underground cavern. They're supposed to be Base 211, which was built in New Swabenland in Antarctica as a final hiding place in case the Germans lost the war, which in fact they did. Now, there has been, there's no getting around the fact that Germany developed rockets far in advance of anything anybody had seen. And supposedly, they sent a man into orbit. Now, it is also no doubt that ever since the Thousand-Year Reich was defeated, it's had a horrible fascination in the popular imagination. And one aspect that interests many is Nazi Germany's frightening array of military hardware. And despite an astonishingly corrupt and incompetent procurement bureaucracy, they fielded some very technologically advanced weapons. They had the Tiger heavy tank, which is the biggest tank, I think, that has ever gone on the battlefield. They had some of the most sophisticated assault rifles out there. They had IR night sights. They had phenomenal fighter planes, the ME-262 jet fighter, and the V-2 ballistic missile. And there is a story that in 1943 they used a nuclear, an atomic bomb to decimate a Soviet regiment. Now, in the past few years, there have been other stories about more amazing schemes from the Third Reich. These stories talk about intercontinental missiles, orbiting space planes. Now, these started out on the internet. And they hold that a number of Luftwaffe pilots made space flights in 1945 until the stories just went away. And the question is there any truth to these stories? Now, Germany was the first nation to field a ballistic missile, and that was Wernher von Braun's V-2, the Vengeance Weapon 2. Now, the name was an invention of Nazi propagandists. It was actually designated the A4, one of the A-series rockets developed by von Braun and his colleagues since the 1930s. The German army began sponsoring von Braun's research even before Hitler came to power. They saw missile weapons as an alternative to the long-range artillery forbidden to post-World War I Germany. Built by a workforce of slaves laboring in hideous underground factories managed by sadistic, murdering thugs, it's said that as many as 20,000 people died building the A4s and about 7,250 more people killed by the missiles. Now, it was a staggeringly futuristic rocket. Rising from its launch pad under 25 tons of thrust from its alcohol and liquid oxygen-fueled engine, it could carry 2,150-pound warhead at supersonic speed up to 195 miles from its launch site. The first successful launch was 1942. It was fired against Allied cities, including London, Antwerp, and Paris. And sometime in 1944, an A4 reached an altitude of 117 miles, which made it the first known man-made object to reach space. Now, impressive though that was, the A4 was not a war-winning weapon. Its range and destructiveness were adequate for a European war, but not for a global war. So aware of this, von Braun and his team investigated longer-range A4 derivatives. One was the A9, an improved winged A4. It was intended to glide up to 497 miles from its launch site. But von Braun had other ideas. The A-10 design was started in 1936 and resembled a giant A-4 with a unique 100-ton thrust engine formed from six of the A-4's engines feeding a single exhaust. Originally, the aim was to carry a 4-ton warhead 310 miles. By 1941, the A-10 had evolved into the lower stage of an intercontinental missile. Mounted on top of an A-10 would be an A-9 launched from western France. They were hoping this combination would be capable of launching warheads at New York City. And just like the space shuttle's SRBs, the A-10 was meant to be reusable, being designed to descend under a parachute into the Atlantic Ocean for recovery. The combined A-9 and A-10 would have been comparable in size to the 1950s Atlas missile. Now, the concept sounds impressive, but at that point in time, it was a fantasy. The whole staging configuration of the A-9-10 was primitive and wouldn't have worked as designed. Now, the Germans planned a piloted craft based on their research. And among the engineering drawings of the A-9 discovered after the war was a set of sketches showing a piloted craft derived from the rocket but with a pressurized cockpit and a tricycle undercarriage. Now, in spite of rumors to the contrary, the A-9, A-10 vehicles weren't meant to carry payloads into orbit. But during his internment with the Allies, von Braun did claim during the war he had designed a reusable orbital space vehicle to assemble and service a wheel-shaped space station. Now, of course, that was discounted, but what if? He called the spacecraft and its launch vehicle the A-11, and they appear to actually have been designed while he was in detention in 1946. Now, the other great Nazi space project was Eugene Sanger Silbervogel, or Antipodal Bomber, which was actually a space plane. Sanger was called the Nazi Germany's other rocket genius. He was a gifted engineer. He'd been investigating supersonic flight and rocket engines since the 30s. And he designed and drew plans for a rocket-powered supersonic passenger aircraft. Now, I read several articles by former Luftwaffe pilots who said that they had, in fact, been in space. Now, it may not have been a full-blown space program as we think of the Apollo program, for example. But certainly, they had the capability to do it as early as the 30s. Now, interestingly enough, if in fact the programs of von Braun and Sanger had been supported by Hitler, we might all be speaking German. Certainly, there have been a number of stories to make the rounds. Some people consider them alternative history. It is known as far back as World War I, there were plans by the Germans to bomb New York. In fact, they found a plane that had been designed to do that. Luckily, prior to the armistice, it had not been finalized. But the plane would have, in fact, allowed a crew to go to New York and drop a fairly good-sized payload of bombs. Now, what would that have done to the Allies had the Germans been able to bomb New York City? During World War II, Hitler had great hopes of, as I said earlier, of the A-9-10 being able to bomb New York City. That seems to have been the goal of so many German programs. Well, let us suppose for a moment that the Nazis, with their society crumbling around them, could they have decided to go for broke? And in fact, launch an expedition into space. They did a lot of things that we would consider crazy and successfully pulled them off. Could they have done it? The fascinating thing is that had they been able to do it, they might well have succeeded. And if they did, that raises so many questions. What if the Nazis beat us to the moon? Certainly, I wrote a book called Is Someone on the Moon? That discusses 400 years of sightings of lights, buildings, and movement on the moon. Somebody's there. There have been, in fact, I tell the story that one of my listeners in California brought me a photograph number and the money to order a photo from NASA. And it was for a time period when no one was supposed to be on the moon, and it showed a track vehicle running across one of the Mars. Well, the track vehicles don't run by themselves. Somebody has to be driving it. So, what that raises so many questions that nobody is ever able to answer. You know, the Nazis were doing research into so many different things. At the end of the war, there was one laboratory in eastern Germany that was supposedly doing research into time travel. Yes, they were into that as well. And one SS regiment, what was left of it, and their families took over that laboratory and caved in the exit. So clearly they thought there was some place for them to go. It wasn't mass suicide, certainly. Now, on the YouTube, you'll find quite a number of stories about Nazis in space. But again, it comes back to the question of evidence. What evidence supports the fact? In fact, so many people that I have, when I do talks, there's always somebody who brings up the issue that They think the Apollo moon landing was filmed in a studio. Certainly that one James Bond film would tend to support that. But it... certainly, I don't think there's a question about whether or not we went to the moon. My question is why we didn't go back. Why don't we have a functioning space base? We certainly have the capability to do it. Well, there have been many, many theories put forth to explain what there's a story, if I can get it to come up on my system, that claims the Nazis were the first to land people on the moon. And after the end of the war, they were supposed to have set up a base. But what happens when you get beyond all that? You know, Operation Paperclip brought some of the most brilliant people on the planet into this country. They had already shown that they could develop the A-2, or the V-2, rather. And by the time they came here in 1945, Wernher von Braun had been researching rocketry for over 15 years. Clearly, they had the capability. And after 43, it was no doubt they were going to lose the war. So why wouldn't they have looked for a place to go? Now, there has been so many stories about Nazis in space. Where there's smoke, there's fire. You can't convince me otherwise. Excuse me. This cold is just something else. All right. We're dealing with a concept that upsets a lot of people. Are we the only life in the universe? Well, certainly the answer to that has to be no. But did for lack of a better term, let's call them the reptilians, get involved in our wars? Where did the Nazis get the advanced technology they demonstrated? I don't think anybody can argue that some of the things that they came up with were mind-boggling. And let's not forget all those strange-looking figures found in the rubble of Berlin wearing the dark robes. Now, I've heard so many people say that, they were monks from Tibet. Why would the Germans have brought monks from Tibet to Berlin? No one's ever been able to answer that question. The sad thing is is my feeling is there's a whole lot more to that story than we've ever been told. I've only found two references to the black-robed corpses. So, why would that be the case if, in fact, they were found? What I find interesting is why did the Germans go to such length and spend resources they didn't really have to spend to track down all the historical weapons of history? I would tend to think they probably knew something that the rest of us don't know. And that raises all kinds of fascinating issues. From where did this information come? Indiana Jones, the movie that everybody loves so much, that franchise, was actually based on a German, a pro-Nazi archaeologist. Now the storm is getting worse. Well, what I find interesting is the fascinating concept Well, it's not everybody who can override my system. The Defense Logistics Agency just did offer me a contract. That's interesting. All right, we during this show have been talking about the possibility that the Nazis went into space. I'm going to be the book that I received today from the publisher is about that very topic. Talks about the Nazi reptilian alien infiltration of the U.S. government and their secret space program. Supposedly, our government is running a program of which the NASA is just window dressing. In fact, NASA basically uses brute force to accomplish what we have many other ways to do. It does raise some very interesting possibilities. This book talks about secret technology such as anti-gravity propulsion, mass mind control, hyperdimensional teleportation capabilities, and something called the 20 and back age regression program. The world is really a very, very strange place. And before we lose power, I'm going to end tonight's show. Till tomorrow night, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.